welcome to your new life and our new times in what has been labeled as humanity's greatest leap in evolution. Dr. K is here to assist you with holistic tips and tools, clearings and activations for your vibrational upgrade. Dr. Allison J. K. has been working as an energy medicine practitioner for 20 years, having lived in Asia for 10 years to study subtle energy. People refer to Dr. K as the lightning bolt due to the high voltage of the work she does on behalf of assisting you to thrive in mind, body, and spirit. That is the greatest backdrop to life on planet Earth right now.
We are today doing the show that is quintessential to how our thoughts create our reality, and we are blessed with the presence of Dr. Amit Goswami. Hi.
Glad to be with you.
Hi. So, Dr. Amit Goswami, I can give a brief bio of you if you'd like.
Well, it's probably important to begin with the fact that I am a quantum physicist. What we are going to talk about is the quantum version of how we create our reality.
So you're trained as a quantum physicist in India, and then you came and taught at the University of Oregon for decades, right?
Right.
Yeah, and you've written many, many books. And for me, the book that really sticks out is The Visionary Window, and that's the work that I quote in my new book, What If There Is Nothing Wrong, helping to show that quantum physics has indeed discovered that at the base of the universe, it's not matter, but it's actually energy, but specifically how the observer effect discovered by in quantum physics shows that our thoughts create our reality.
Yeah, consciousness is the ground of all being, and we, as part of that consciousness, create our reality whenever we tune in into the whole. And unfortunately, we cannot create reality in our ego. That's the catch in the whole phrase, that it's a little bit subtle. When we are partial, when we are part only, when we identify with the part that is us, that is the individual, then we lose the general power of creation of something new. Then we can create, but we can create only the old with a little bit of freedom to go over the whole spectrum of our conditioned stuff that we have built in our brain. So we have some creative power, but it's limited to what is already in the brain. Whereas when we let go of that identity and open up to the universe, then the universe creates with us, and that's where the greatest power of creation lies. That's what creative people do. That's what you need to heal yourself with quantum healing. That's what one needs to become spiritual and happy forever and all that.
So in as much of a nutshell, because you are so good at being concise about these huge complex ideas, simplifying them, you talked about the observer effect and what that does, how that shows that our thoughts create our reality. Can you talk about that, please?
Absolutely. Quantum physics is the physics of possibility. So objects are conceived of, and this is true experimentally, verified repeatedly, objects are possibilities. So the question of observer effect is that when we observe these possibilities, we never see possibility. We only see actualities. The wave of possibility becomes a particle of actuality. We find an electron, for example, which is supposed to be spread all over the room or all over a town. As soon as we are observing it in a particular electron detector. So this is a problem. What is in the observer that causes it, that has this power? And this problem becomes very, very mysterious when we realize that material interactions just cannot do it. This is a mathematical theorem that the great mathematician John von Neumann proved, that quantum physics just does not allow these possibilities to become actuality. So then the question is, what does it do it? If material interactions gonna do it, what does it? And the answer is that we do it, consciousness. Consciousness because it's the ground of being. It's not a brain phenomenon. Brain is a phenomenon of consciousness. When we get our concepts upside down like this,
yeah.
Although it's not completely upside down, you have to remember that spiritual traditions are talking like this for millennia. So it's not, in that sense, not completely surprising. But the surprising right. stuff comes too, which the spiritual traditions quite didn't grasp it. So there is new science. There really is new creativity involved in all this. So the observer effect is that we choose the particular actuality that we create out of the possibilities in every given observation. And this is where, if we become aware of it, that if we tune in to the holistic consciousness, the whole enchilada that consciousness is, then the power of creation really is quite unlimited. It's fascinating to think about it.
Oh my God, yes. Dr. Goswami, but what happens if a person isn't tuned in to how to use consciousness? They're still creating their reality in their thoughts, their lives. Pardon me. They're still creating their lives and what they experience.
Yeah, absolutely. They're still creating their lives, except that what happens, ordinary creation, when you just create from what you have already conditioned in the brain, what happens is that you don't perceive it with an element of conviction. It's more or less sort of, if you watch it carefully, you will see that there is nothing that is special about such choices. You know, we make such choices all the time. What flavor of ice cream would you like? Would you like vanilla or chocolate? We say, no, I don't like either one of them. I like banana today. You know, that's a choice. But we don't particularly feel that we are doing something out of conviction that will start us in a new path. Whereas what happens when you choose the very new is that you feel that you have really discovered something, some truth. It has truth. That truth value escapes us when you do the same old, and the feeling we get is a mundane feeling. Whereas when you discover the new, it's what we call sacred. Something happens to us which gives us such a wonderful force of conviction that we really carry that out and make the change. That ability to go on and make the change is what is different. You know, creativity does not end with the idea. Creativity ends with the manifestation of the idea into a product. That takes tenacity. That takes perseverance. That takes a lot of effort. To have that effort is that conviction. People, there are many people who come up with ideas during the course of a day, but they never put those ideas into action, into something of a product, either personal change or a product for other people to enjoy, a creative product. Why not? Because they don't discover them with that conviction, what we call a quantum leap. Something new comes out of the possibility spectrum and becomes manifest. This is what we need to learn.
That's brilliant how you put that. Because the idea doesn't come up with conviction, they don't follow through because they're in the mundane, everyday world. It makes me think of the classification you provided in the visionary window of the quantum self versus the ego self.
Right. That's it. So quantum self is alive with this new energy of discovery. And therefore, when we are in touch with the quantum self, nothing seems insurmountable. And that's the key. Nothing seems insurmountable because it seems that the force of the universe is behind us. This is why when we tune in, we find that synchronicities constantly help us when we are in a creative project. Synchronicity meaning that things will happen coincidentally, which seems like chance events, but they're not really chance events. That's the cooperation that, if you will, God is giving us. That's the cooperation where holistic consciousness, quantum consciousness, is involved. In other words, you don't have just your power. The entire power of the universe is pushing you. And this is what gives us the ability of carrying through that change, the product.
So Dr. Goswami, when you find that people are not having the backing of the universe, when they're not aware of the power of consciousness, and that that actually is much more powerful than the physical solidity, like let's say somebody has a cancer diagnosis and the doctor says you have 3 months to live, and that person doesn't know about consciousness, and then somebody like me comes in because a family member said, okay, let's try an alternative or natural healing, and somebody like me comes in with energy healing and talks to them about the potential. What are they? It's like, I think in the popular culture of quantum leaping, it seems like the way people understand quantum leaping is it's this big thing. You have to make this drastic shift in your life to allow for a quantum leap, and all this preparation is required ahead of time to be able to handle that kind of energy or consciousness. So if a person who has never been opened up is opened up by crisis and they need an alternative and they come to a healer to help them with their cancer, what would you recommend as the way to easily help them believe that the consciousness can be shifted?
Yeah, this is a very, very good question. How do we precipitate, how do we help quantum healing? We can greatly help as a healer. The reason is that the healer has a healthy perspective already. Whereas when the person who is suffering, although the crisis does produce wonderful opening, anybody who has been with a patient who has been declared to have a finite lifetime within a few months knows how all of a sudden the person becomes very clear about things. And that clearness, clarity, is symptomatic of an openness that creativity requires. So the person is open for creativity. What the person is not open for, of course, is that we are very cavalier. We are very obstructionist as regards to our own conditioning and our operations of our unconscious. Yes, we just are not very good analyzers of events that take place precipitated by the unconscious. Yeah. We are not very aware of what the dynamics of the unconscious is. And this is why, of course, we call it unconscious. But the dynamics is operating. It's precipitating events all the time. So right. A careful analyzer, a psychoanalyst, a mind-body healer, can analyze that and see that the cancer is really due to a certain blockage of energy at a certain chakra. You are familiar with the chakras. I hope all listeners are. So, for example, let's take women's breast cancer. That is a good example of, we know that many, many of these breast cancer cases are really a case of blocking heart energy, energy of love, mainly precipitated by grieving, by loneliness. The energy just doesn't flow in the heart chakra, right, which is the site of the immune system in the form of the thymus gland. So that energy block, it often is a mental block. It's an energy block, but originating from something that the mind decided, that the head decided, that love is painful, or head decided that love cannot happen without this particular person, which is not true. But the head decides that, no, this person, I have been with this person for so long, without that person, life is meaningless, I can never love again. And so the mind closes down the flow of energy in the heart chakra in the form of love. So now that has to be opened up, but that cannot be opened up at the same level where the problem was created. Mind created the problem, and it cannot be opened up at the level of the mind. We have to go to the supermind, supramental, which is the next level up, level of intuition, where we can only access by intuition and creativity. So this is where the person is in despair, right? He or she is dying. So this is where a healer who brings the positive perspective, if the healer can now correlate, this is the quantum concept, correlate, mm-hmm. become entangled with the person, with the healee, that is the challenge for the healer. But, you know, the problem with current healers, of course, is that they don't have the time. They have only 15 minutes, or if you're a psychiatrist, 1 hour. To deal with a patient. So that is not what is going to work. The healing process has to be changed in our professional situations in these kind of cases. And the insurance companies and everybody else has to come to terms with this, that the demands are different here. Demand is that there has to be a relationship between the healer and the healee. And only then, that tangled relationship, what we call quantum entanglement or quantum correlation, that makes the two systems as one. So your positivity, the healer's positivity then, can overcome the negativity of the healee, and the together, they can be much more creative than one person could. Now, that requires a lot from the healer, but, you know, healers also benefit. But this is the thing, Alison. Healers can also benefit because when the healing occurs in such a case, the healee gets to heal the cancer. But you know, all people who have gone into healer, and I know many such healers who come to my workshops, or I know them anyway, and all of them have one desire. You know, all healers come to the profession of healing because they want wholeness, which they miss. It's a positive wholeness. They already have health, so it's not that they want to heal themselves from what you call disease, but they want to heal themselves from what we feel as separation. Ego is a separateness. They want to move to a higher plane where that separateness gives way to a happiness, to a wholeness. And so they're also healed in this process of quantum healing when it takes place in conjunction with the effort of both healer and healee. So, you know, I am completely in support of this kind of approach, which can be done. I mean, the Simontons, I understand, they have a clinic in Arizona where people can go and they use the creative process using visualizations and all. And they are personally involved with everyone in that clinic, the couple. So it can be done. It is being done. And I hope that it becomes much more universal. This current thinking that terminal cancer is terminal has to be eradicated because we have cases of spontaneous healing.
I've done it, Dr. Goswami, actually. I've done it first and foremost, but also afterwards, but I've done it first and foremost with a brain tumor that my mother was diagnosed with 3 months left to live, and with energy healing and working with the thoughts and the beliefs, we undid a brain tumor, and the MRI showed no brain tumor eventually, and the doctors at the local cancer center called it a miracle. We talked about correlation. I also would love, because you're such a unique marriage of quantum physics and your knowledge of the Upanishads and yogic tradition in the ancient wisdom that comes out of India. How does when somebody, so I would love to actually use your wisdom in this unique framing that you have, your own being and intelligence has because of who you are and where you come from. When somebody's on the yogic path, Dr. Goswami, and they're starting to awaken or starting the path towards enlightenment or the kundalini is starting to rise, they're starting to touch into the higher field. Can you speak to that?
Yeah, of course.
This is
a privilege to speak about that. First of all, you know, I mean, people do that. People do that, and then, of course, there are some misconceptions, too.
Yeah.
Like the yogic process of Patanjali, who wrote, like, you know, 2,000 years ago, it's amazing. The process that Patanjali gives, although it's shrouded in a very localized language of that time, and so subject to many interpretations, unfortunately. But if you are a quantum physicist and know about quantum creativity, you would see immediately that Patanjali is giving the recipe exactly of what the creative process is that we have discovered only in the past 100 years and the quantum theory behind it. In other words, that same process, preparation, unconscious processing, quantum leap, insight, and manifestation. Patanjali talks about in exactly the same thing with different language, Sanskrit words, so a little bit obscure And of course, people love to mystify things to make it special. It's not available to everybody, that kind of feeling. It's esoteric. It's not. It's really available to everybody, except, of course, we need certain readiness. What is the readiness for spirituality? This is a very important thing. So readiness is that I want to change. That's the readiness. If I don't want to change, then my creativity will always be to create a product in the outer world that people will admire. I'll acquire name and fame and some money and prosperity and all that. But after we have done that a while, then we become curious. Can this be used to change and bring happiness in my life, perpetual happiness and bliss? And when we want that, then we become inner creative, creative of the inner world. Our inner ecology becomes more important than the outer ecology to us. So that's the readiness I'm talking about. And then the creative process is identical in the yoga and the quantum, the new science. So we use the creative process, we discover the archetypes to live by, and we discover how to become better and more tuned and more happy. But this is not what gives us perpetual happiness. So there is a final question, that how does one arrive at perpetual happiness? And this is where there's a lot of misconception in both the yogic literature, in the Upanishadic literature, and of course in modern times, that confusion has multiplied. People are very confused about what is really enlightenment. Confusion arises because if you do this creative process in the inner world and want to know what yourself is, really the nature of the self, which is in the quantum physics, we call it the quantum self, quantum self shows itself. I mean, it's not such a mystery, really. Quantum self shows itself every day when we are intuiting something. And intuitive thoughts come to everybody at least once or twice every day. We just don't pay attention. So it's not such a rare thing. But of course, the desire to live in the quantum self is a rare thing. It requires some preparation, requires some openness to the inner world and openness to change of character. So that is a little bit rare. But when that happens, we can do it. I mean, we go through the creative process and quantum self shows itself and we have that insight that I am the quantum self. But then comes the big question. What do I have to do to identify with the quantum self? Mm. We have to give up the ego. And that's the big step. That step cannot be done until you are ready to give up all accomplishment. And this is what the problem is. Today we have many enlightened people, but they don't want to give up the ego. They want to succeed in the world as nothing but as a guru. And that is unfortunately the story of humanity right now. We are trapped in the idea that we can use even enlightenment as a vehicle for accomplishment. But that doesn't happen. This is why today's gurus always fall short in some scandals, in some behavior patterns, which everybody can see except them, that it's not quite up to par. They're suppressing emotions. They're not really behaving in an enlightened way. They're are kind of narcissistic that continues. And all these difficulties we have and scandals that we have with gurus and spiritual teachers, you know, this is a problem, right? So how to go beyond it? We have to have another preparation. So first preparation was that I'm ready to look at change of my character. And the second level of preparation is that I really have to be completely aware that the world is not bringing me that wholeness, that happiness. And the world itself then can be abandoned. I can give up my accomplishment orientation. But you have to be ready to give up accomplishment. You have to be ready. That readiness occurs when you just don't want to accomplish anymore. You really then feeling like, you know, that been there, done that. I already have accomplished love, accomplished success, accomplished abundance, accomplished health, accomplished. So I have nothing more to accomplish. I'm tired of accomplishing. I don't want to accomplish anymore, right? Now imagine, I am very far from it, I'll confess. and so probably are you. And so, so for us to declare ourselves enlightened is meaningless, because yes, can we have quantum self-experience? Yes, we can, of course. You know, but the point is that to identify with it, to give up the ego, to give back up accomplishment, no, I'm not ready for it. If somebody is not ready for it, then you see how empty the enlightenment is, because you're not really manifesting the identity with quantum self, although you know that you are the quantum self, but you are afraid to manifest it, because then that would mean you give up the ego. All the accomplishments you have to give up, and who is ready to give up? I have not met any one person in my entire life. I have not met one person, including some very great spiritual teachers, who are not quite ready yet. A thread, wholesome. There's still a feeling of accomplishment, and that's what is holding them from taking that final step.
But the feeling of, so would you say the feeling of the desire to share and have others, when they choose to grow and feel the fullness of the quantum self and the fullness of the universe and all its beauty that it offers, to share the tools that, like myself, I know of, is that still geared towards accomplishment?
I can put it that way, but what happens is that that eagerness, that willingness, which is quite lofty, quite nice, but it is as an accomplishment, because ego is doing it. Whereas what happens to a Buddha, on the other hand, look at the Buddha story. It's beautiful, mythical, of course, but in Buddha got attained nirvana, which is total extinction. All desires went away, no accomplishment anymore, right? Buddha is ready. Buddha is enlightened. So what happens, Buddha says, thought of Buddha is that who will understand this? You know, there is nothing to do anymore, because, you know, this is not anything that I can ever share. But then the myth goes, says gods come to him. Gods come to him and convince him that you do it. Now, what does that mean? You know, you take away the mythical language. What does it mean? So in simple terms, what it means is that the actions appropriately open up for Buddha. So Buddha is acting always from the quantum self. How do we know that? We know that because Buddha is not attached to what happens with a program, or what doesn't happen with a program, what happens with a person, what doesn't happen with a person. Buddha is not attached to any of it. Buddha can walk away or not walk away as appropriate in a given situation. That's the difference. Whereas what happens when you are in the ego and trying to do good, that, okay, I have discovered something great and people will be good if they can learn it, if I can teach it, if I can talk about it, if I can share it, all that sounds lofty, but they're not flowing from the quantum self as appropriate, as dependent on the situation. The point is Buddha and Jesus still has to live. So if their life fulfills in that certain way, if they just go on flowering and people take advantage of what fragrance they're emanating, that's a different thing. But when we make it an ego affair, then invariably the ego gets inflated, and that's how all the seeds of corruption enter.
Do you think it's possible to live in the world today, in the West today?
Absolutely, it's possible, but the challenge is huge. The challenge is huge, and I must say, you know, I mean, as I said, I am not ready for it, and I haven't met anybody who is quite ready for it. It's a huge accomplishment, and if you ask this question to a person like Dalai Lama, who is a fantastic man, very realistic about himself, he would also say the same thing. He's not ready for it. So the readiness is everything. Will there be such a ready person in our lifetime? We don't know. And, you know, such people are really very rare. In Hinduism, there is a word called avatara, which is used for such rarefied people. And there are only a few, although may not be as few as 10, which is in Hindu mythology. I believe that there probably are many more than 10 during the course of human history. But still, I mean, the point is that they certainly are not as as frequently as people declared enlightenment today. And there are many, many people who have declared they're enlightened, but no, they're not ready to give up their ego in the sense that I'm talking about.
Dr. Goswami, you're reminding me of when I was in India and I was doing my yoga teacher training, and I listened to the Brahmin teacher of the philosophy of Patanjali Sutras, and he said in ancient India, the sages about 5,000 years ago asked the question, where do we have more control in human life, over the internal world or the external? And unlike the West, they chose the internal and then developed the yogic practices and then the meditation that's part of the yogic path as the tools to work with the inner landscape where they saw the increased potential for control. Whereas in my book is so much centered around this idea, and that in the West, the choice was made back when modern science began split from the church to say we have, because of our religious background and then science being based on Christianity, turned and tuned out to the external world. Do you see that merging?
Well, yes, I see that merging, and you must take into account the actual history, Alison, because otherwise you get confused.
Please. Yeah.
I don't think that when the ancient Indians or the ancient Hebraic people or the ancient Greeks chose to look at the mind, you know, I'm talking about Socrates, Plato, and the Kabbalah tradition in Israel and the Hindu traditions. When they were choosing, the material option did not exist. We did not have the technology to pursue material science, laws of physics and all that. We just did not have the technology to do it. So there was no choice. Human creativity, of course, goes on and does what is possible. At that time, it was only possible to look inwards, and they did, and we are happy that they did. And the mistake we make today is to ignore their great science. It is a science that they did, like I was saying. The Patanjali Yoga Sutra is science of creativity. No question about it. If you are a quantum physicist and looking at from that angle, you see the parallel right away. So what they discovered is scientific, except it's the science of the inner experience, the science of the inner world. We are not ready to do the outer world as of yet. Technology was not developed. Technology developed in the 16th, 17th century, and immediately we started doing it. Everything has a timing, and that is important to recognize. So now, again, we have another shift in timing. Now that we have done the material part a lot, and we have discovered that even matter at some level becomes quantum, and it is quantum at all levels, except that the quantum is very subdued in the macroscopic world, so we didn't see it in the time of Newton. But now we have seen it, that everything is really quantum, matter and mind, and we now have the ability and the philosophy and the science to incorporate both matter and mind into one unified science. And this is the time to go and integrate science and spirituality. My work is already showing that it is completely possible to integrate it, completely possible to integrate alternative medicine and regular medicine. It's completely possible to integrate spirituality into even economics. You know, really, integration can happen. But, of course, right now it's all polarization. So the big challenge for the society is how to get this integrative science into the mix of society to start solving the social problems in an integrated way.
Well, that's...
Go ahead.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead.
Okay. You have you've participated in some of the Dalai Lama's workshops, and Dr. Goswami, I have reviewed a lot of the Mind Life Institute biennial conferences he's had with his team of Tibetan geishas. I'm not saying that correctly, I don't think, the Tibetan equivalent of PhDs with Western scientists like Richard Davidson of University of Madison, Wisconsin, and like Daniel Goleman, and yourself as well, to understand where can science, the Western science, help prove now the in measurement the effects of Buddhism, which I term the science of the mind. what do you see expanding from that work? Because that then brings in also your work as with what you just said, how it can help us in how it can help us with economics, how it can help us bring spirituality and the quantum self to everything. And that's basically, it seems like what he's also working towards doing by proving with the scientists in the West, the measuring the effects of meditation.
Yeah, some of it is common to all of us, like, for example, bringing meditation into the mainstream culture. But where we go, there are some blocks here. Mm-hmm. You see, the whole movement started with, first of all, the thinking that if we can just bring in holism in addition to reductionism, which dominates science. Let me clarify that a little. Reductionism is the idea that everything can be reduced to smaller and smaller. Holism is the idea that no, reductionism doesn't do it the entire job. At a holistic level, when systems become composite, new things can emerge, which cannot be reduced to the interactions of the components of the body. For example, when atoms make molecules, some whole holistic stuff will emerge from it. But this idea of holism goes only so far. It's a good idea that there are some irreducible characteristics in some systems, composite systems, like living systems and conscious systems. But the idea of holism, that matter alone, when they make composites, can do it, that's faulty. That's faulty, and we cannot go into details here, of course, because our time is limited. So that attitude still dominates a very large number of people in the new science movement, which tries to integrate science and spirituality. But that, this, as I said, is limited. It's faulty. It's partial. It's incomplete. So, and then the next idea that became very popular because of the influence of Eastern teachers who came in the 60s and 70s to America and Europe, and their influence was great, and so the thought occurred that if we can incorporate the Eastern metaphysics in psychology, then maybe we can solve the problem. So we have transpersonal psychology, which is based on the Eastern metaphysics that consciousness is the ground of being. And then we have a layer of matter and then mind and then supermind and all that. So, but this still does not integrate because matter is left out. Matter is the domain of science and their reductionistic thinking or holistic thinking, whatever have you, holds. And they keep sort of the internal-external, this dualism continues. And it's a little bit elitist also because the mind is put at a higher level than matter and supermind is even at a higher level. But it's not quite recognized that what is higher level, this level aspect confuses the issues enormously. So that's an attempted integration because you're integrating East and West, but not quite because you're not recognizing that science applies even to the inner world. And recently, the breakthrough came when we realized that, no, the inner world also can be measured. We thought for a long time that we cannot measure thought. We cannot measure our feelings. But now, with Carlian photography, that started almost like 45 years ago, we can measure the energies of emotions. And similarly with MRI techniques, magnetic resonance imaging techniques, we can measure the effect of thought on the brain. Of course, materialists tout these pictures as a picture of brain producing mental thought, but you can discard that. That's another faulty thinking. The right way of thinking is that the effect of the mind, the effect of thought, produces effect in the brain, and by measuring the brain changes, you can actually measure the change in thought that is taking place in your mind. So mind can be measured, vital energies can be measured. Supramental, we cannot measure as of yet because supramental is not represented in our body, in any organ. So, but mind and vital energies can be measured to that. Subtle can be measured. This is makes it imperative that we must then realize that the whole thing, external and internal, both are scientific. And that can be incorporated only if you take a quantum worldview. You say everything is quantum, because everything then is possibility, so you can declare that consciousness is the ground of all being, in which there are four compartments of possibility. One is matter, one is mind, one is vital energy, one is the supramental, the values, the archetypes and all. So in this way, I have developed a science of experience. Whereas what happens with other kinds of thinking, as I said, they are integrators, but a limited extent. And so, you know, it will take a while for people to accept. Quantum, you know, Alison, you are very kind. You are very receptive to the word quantum. But many people get afraid because they immediately associate there's a lot of mathematics and can I understand quantum. They make it too difficult for them to overcome. But it's really easier than Newtonian physics. And the understanding that has to occur is at the level of some basic patterns of thought rather than mathematics. You don't have to understand any mathematics to understand quantum, really. But people don't quite grasp it. So it's a little bit of fear associated, and that's why more people continue to read more books on holism and books on transpersonal psychology rather than the quantum science, which, of course, consists more than me. It's not just me, but there are quite a few other thinkers, Arvind Laszlo and Henry Stapp and Fred Allen Wilson, Casey Blood, quite a few people who are contributing. And their number grows every day for contributing to the new quantum science. But the quantum view is the only one that can really incorporate the inner and the outer. There is no other way of incorporating everything in within a science.
But you're a pioneer, Dr. Goswami. You're a leader in how to practically apply quantum physics discoveries into life. I know that when I've talked to quantum physicists, they were hesitant in bringing the discoveries in the laboratory out into life because they said that it lost its purity and it's not applicable. And then in reading your book and in reading other quantum physicists' books, the discussion about so many of the quantum physicists have left orthodox scientific research positions in order to explore science with less restrictions because orthodox science doesn't accept a lot of what you're saying. What has been your experience with why doesn't the average person know that this quantum world is actually the newest discovery of science, and why isn't our society more radically changing? I mean, why such hesitancy? Because it brings in personal responsibility?
Well, that's part of it. But also don't forget that if people become very entrenched with what they actually do in the laboratory. In the laboratory, so far they're studying only matter. The study of vital energies, although it is now becoming a little more widespread, you have to go to vital energy conferences, of which there are quite a few in America and elsewhere during the year. Then you get a feeling that, yeah, a lot of people are studying these things. But even there, their approach generally tend to be inclined towards a materialist worldview, because otherwise they fear that their work would not be accepted. They don't realize that materialist worldview really cannot admit that there is such a thing as vital energy. So there is a lot of fear enter into the situation, fear on the part of materialists, because they are afraid if they embrace a more general worldview, they will be pariahs. In fact, very great scientists have confessed to me in private conversation that they just don't dare to talk about consciousness in the same vein as quantum physics, because there will be pariahs in their community. They will lose their grants, and people will become antagonistic to invite them to conferences and grants, research grants and stuff. And so it's still, it's very reminiscent of the situation that existed in the 16th, 17th, 18th century, when modern science was battling with the Christian church. There was a lot of fear for scientists. But, of course, very quickly we developed the academic institutions, which then provided a shield. So similarly, today our challenge is to develop similar academic institutions, taking advantage of somewhat relaxed academic educational system that exists in America and to some extent even in Europe, although in the developing countries the situation is much more closed. For example, in India, to change the educational system is very, very tough. But in America, you know, we can do it. The scope is better. Although there still is a lot more pressure. In some fields, it's practically impossible. Like American Medical Association is extremely powerful and extremely reactionary in this respect. But other systems are not so bad. And hopefully, you know, this struggle will take about 100 years, my judgment, as it did for the struggle of modern science in the 16th and 17th centuries. So, you know, human beings cannot change very fast. You know, what is that line from T.S. Eliot? Humankind cannot dwell with too much reality, cannot bear too much reality. So humankind can never bear too much reality, and we are giving too much reality right now to the materialists. So you have to be patient.
Oh, but it's so exciting because Wilde is the response. If our thoughts are then, in fact, in creating our reality, yes, there's huge responsibility with that, but there is such empowerment with that because that frees us up to be able to create what we desire, what's good. I mean, it's, why would we then still create suffering? I know that's an idealistic viewpoint that I'm presenting right now. I know that the average person is more comfortable in the familiar. It's just, it's still a question for me about humanity.
It's a good question. And my answer is really, that answer that is emerging in my work now is that the answer is economics. If we show that these products that we are talking about, vital energy, mental meaning, and spiritual values, this product, like happiness, I talked about happiness a whole lot. We talked about happiness a whole lot. This kind of thing can be commodities of the economic arena. But that's a huge step. No, for ages we have had such dictum. Money cannot buy love. Money cannot buy happiness. And then suddenly we realize with the help of quantum physics and the new science that, oh, well, yes, we can. Actually, money can buy happiness because I can create a perpetually happy person. And then if I am in the presence of such a person, I do become happy. I have had met two such people. I mean, they really are as close to enlightened as I have met. I mean, my wife and I were walking by the Ganges in a place called Rishikesh in India. And a person invites us in, says, Laughing Baba is talking. Would you like to hear it? Said, sure. So we went in, and Baba is talking on a stage in Hindi, which I cannot understand. So I sat down, but I was bored. I'm looking around. It's about 5 minutes looking around, and all of a sudden, I notice something. Everyone's face is beaming with smile. And I examine my own face. Yes, I am also smiling. And smile spread to the eyes. I mean, you know, it's not a fake smile. So why am I smiling? And all of a sudden, the thought came to me that, this is why this fellow is called Laughing Baba, the father in front of which I laugh, which means I become happy. And I noticed myself, oh, my God, I have become happy. I'm happy right now, really. That's why I'm smiling. The smile is a symptom of my happiness. So I recognize, so this person brings happiness, even though it's temporary, in his presence only. So, you know, and this is not just one person. I met an American mystic, and the same thing happened. I was very unhappy during that period, and I went to his ashram and stayed there for a few weeks, and one day I entered the breakfast room, and everybody's talking about this delightful quantum physicist. And I demanded to know, who is this quantum physicist? I have not met him yet. And everybody laughed. And I realized all of a sudden, I am that quantum physicist who has become very happy. So, you know, these things are not unreal. We can actually Seduce such people in whose proximity we become happy. And so if some entrepreneur produces such a farm in which such laughing babas will be produced and he brings them to New York or Philadelphia or other big centers and has an office and there's a sign, happiness for sale, $100 per an hour, you know, who can refuse? Who can refuse?
Right.
So we can do it. We have to do it that way. We have to have, we have to be optimistic. We have to work on this ourselves and see if we can open up happiness, fountain of happiness so that other people immediately get some induced happiness. And in that way, since we are not averse to charging money because money doesn't, if money doesn't mean anything, then why can I, can't I charge money and use it for good use?
Yeah.
So, and happiness become part of the economic arena. In that way, we can change the world very fast. If it becomes part of the economy, you know.
Yeah, that's huge. Because as I talk to people more and more in the 2 years since I've returned from the 10 years in Asia, and I'm in America, and I'm looking at the changes that have happened in the 10 years, as I listen to people talk, I'm still hearing the seemingly mutual exclusivity of money on the left and spirituality and or happiness on the right, and they're not able to be married together. Yet there's a group of people who are saying, oh no, yes, it is, it can be together. And
yes,
in fact, that's where we're going. So it's brilliant.
That's where we are going. And that is the true integration of science and spirituality. For a long time, people still say that science and spirituality can never mix. Quantum physics has proven them wrong. Quantum physics is clarifying spiritual traditions, the mysticism, which is called mysticism because it always has been kind of misty. But now it's no longer misty. I can explain spirituality to people who never thought they could understand what it means with quantum physics. The language makes it so clear. And so, you know, the same thing happens when we bring in these wonderful spiritual fountains into the economic arena. People find that, yes, they can use these things in their everyday life, and then they become curious. Okay, if I can buy happiness, why don't I try to be happiness myself? Why don't I become, instead of a consumer, a producer? And that's how the society can change, because more people get into that curiosity of becoming a producer of happiness, then the world can change very fast.
Yes, because it is contagious, by God.
Yes.
How do people get in touch with you, sir?
I have a website, which is a very simple one, Amit Goswami, my whole name, and .org.
And it's on the bottom right, you guys, of the show. Excuse me, Dr. Goswami, I just want to direct people to see, if you look to the bottom right, you can see about this guest, and you can see Dr. Goswami's bio, and links to his two different websites linked to down there on the bottom right of the same page. So where can they see you? And you're working on a new book, too, or you have just produced another new book.
The new book is called Quantum Creativity, Think Quantum, Be Creative. And the other new book that I am just in the beginning process of writing, actually two new books. One is called Economics of Consciousness, or maybe Spiritual Economics. I have not decided on a name yet. And the other is called Quantum Psychology.
Oh, brilliant. I can't wait to read them. I like Spiritual Economics. I like that one.
Okay. I'll note it down.
Thank you, sir.
One more vote for spiritual economics. Okay.
That's how I did my book title. What if there's nothing wrong? I did the voting.
Yeah, the title, you know, it's very difficult to decide on for an author.
What's your pearl of wisdom for the day, Dr. Goswami? Or sitting with me for now, what would be your pearl of wisdom for me that would be relevant to the audience?
It's always basically the same one. Quantum physics is opens us to potentiality. The potential is huge. I mean, it's just huge, infinite. So, you know, waking up to that quantum potential, in the capacity of everyone. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes some suffering, it takes ups and downs, true. But you have to go through the suffering, ups and downs anyways. There's no way of avoiding those things anyhow. So why not make it directed in such a way that we can reveal more and more of this potentiality and actualize them in the world? And in that way, our own life becomes more satisfying, and we can also make our neighbor's lives more satisfying. So isn't that what everyone should do?
That is indeed what I'm doing. I am so grateful for your beauty and your wisdom in blessing me with that. And you're in this hour of your time in your beautiful heart that just pours over the sound waves. Yeah?
Thank you, Alison, for being you.
That's what I said to him. The very first sentence I said to him, y'all, before we went on air was, thank you for being you in this world. isn't he a treat?
Yes, what goes around comes around.
I look forward to shaking hands with you, sir, someday soon. Where we can get a schedule of your workshops coming up when we go to your website, right?
Right, yes.
Okay. Blessings to you, Dr. Goswami. And again, thank you for all that you've done for our planet and all that you're continuing to do for our world. It's brilliant work and it's needed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Namaste.
Thank you for joining us and allowing yourself this time to expand and become more of who you're here to be. Dr. K has a range of different offerings of her vibrational upgrades at all price points, including free. So for more information, please go to www.alisonjk.com. Dr. K's first book, What If There's Nothing Wrong, is available on Amazon.com. Dr. K also has a weekly clearing and activation call that is attended by her most advanced clients and students, an important activity in keeping themselves aligned and their vibration high. We'd love to have you come and play. Om Shanti.